Chapter 30, Around the World. My plane tickets to Laos had arrived. The prospect of living with my father excited me. It would be my first time living with him since before I went to military school, and he to Vietnam. He left in 1966. It was now 1971. I was also enthusiastic about being able to finally make a modest contribution to the anti-communist war effort. I looked forward to seeing firsthand the nations and races I had read about in my quest for racial understanding. I felt like a botanist making a first trip to the Amazon. I arranged my itinerary to take me to nations I had long desired to visit, and I left weeks earlier than my assignment began, so I had a chance for a lengthy visit to the nations I had chosen. After a 2-day stopover in Hawaii, I headed to Japan, Hong Kong, Saigon, Bangkok, and finally Vientiane. The first great impression of my trip was flying into Tokyo. As the plane came within 50 miles of Tokyo Harbor, cruising at 35,000 feet, the dawn sky was crystal clear. On the horizon, I could see ships and tankers strung out in endless lines. They were steaming in, filled with raw resources, and leaving bursting with finished business products and consumer goods. Once the plane had landed, I noticed that the airport was spotlessly clean, and so were the people. I rode in the subways and found them filled with well-dressed and well-groomed men and women. Not a single derelict was in sight. Many of the people had good knowledge of English, and I spoke to as many as I could, trying to get a feel for their culture and their lifestyle. The people had no fear of crime, and I could see the natural harmony of the nation everywhere. There are a few dissidents and angry elements in Japan, because the nation is truly a reflection of its people's spirit. Seldom did I see so much as a gum wrapper on the pavement, and once when I saw a tiny wrapper blow away from a man in a wind gust, 3 people passing by jumped at once, almost knocking into each other, to pluck it from the gutter. On relating the gum wrapper incident to a Japanese student I had met named Toshi, he told me that all the Japanese feel a kinship with each other. The sense of a common heritage and a common destiny makes the Japanese nation somewhat like a huge family. Certainly the greater Japanese family has its squabbles, but when threatened by outside forces or common problems, they band together to solve them. "You want to know why Japanese don't litter?" said Toshi. "It's because throwing litter in the street is like throwing trash in a relative's home." He told me that every Japanese person is taught from the time he's very young of the noble history of the Japanese people, and each child learns that he's a vital part of that tradition, and that he and others like him are now its guardians and keepers. They teach him that if he personally fails, that his family and tradition fails as well. Not only is he responsible for himself, but he must take a personal responsibility for his own nation, and ultimately, even for the meaning of their ancestors' sacrifices. Worship of one's ancestors is common throughout Japan. The rich racial and cultural tradition and artistic community unites the people in a sense of brotherhood unparalleled in the world. Japan's history also refutes one of the main explanations used to explain Africa's lack of development. Afrocentrists say that sub-Saharan Africa failed to develop into modern civilized states because of its isolation from the rest of the world. Yet many black African states were near the great ancient civilizations, and the Arab world colonized Africa for millennia. In stark contrast to Africa, Japan completely cut itself off from the rest of the world in the modern era, from 1603 to 1867, the Tokugawa Shogun period. By 1900, only about 30 years after reestablishing contact in 1867, Japan emerged as a world power. In 40 more years, it became a manufacturing giant. Then, after the almost complete destruction of its industry and a terrible loss of life in the Second World War, its economy became second in the world only to that of the United States. And it must be remembered that Japan accomplished these gains despite being a small, crowded, and resource-exhausted nation. Could Japan's secret be partly that it is all Japanese? The largest minority group in the entire nation is Korean, and they constitute only about 2% of the population. And they differ from the Japanese in a similar, slight degree, as, say, the Irish do from the English. I walked around Tokyo one day during my visit and did not see a single Caucasian or Negro. That is, until I went to the top of the Japanese tower. On the observation deck, I saw my first white man of the day. And when he turned around, I saw that his female companion was black. I wondered if the couple was a symbol of American racial diversity and dissolution, and indicative of the degeneration of our social health in comparison with that of the proud and ethnocentric Japanese. My next stop was Hong Kong. Going from the airport into Kowloon and seeing the uncountable numbers of people in the streets, I gained a true sense of the incredible population of Asia. I talked to some tourist guides who told me that many of the Chinese in Hong Kong live in apartments by the shift. They sleep and cook there for a third of the 24-hour period and then leave the apartment for the other two shifts of tenants who do the same thing. I took the tram to the top of the beautiful Hong Kong Island at dusk and saw one of the most magnificent views of my life. The dark hills of China up against the bright lights of Kowloon and the well-lighted ships dotting the magnificent harbor below. It was a romantic scene, but I was a long way from my love, Chloe, and felt even lonelier, soaking in its beauty by myself. I then noticed a white man on the observation walk. He turned out to be the same one I had seen in Tokyo. And yes, the same black female accompanied him. Is there a point to this coincidence? I thought. From there, I flew to South Vietnam and the beautiful city of Saigon. I looked up a couple of my father's friends, and they helped me understand the lay of the land. No one I talked to thought Nixon's Vietnamization program would work. George McGovern, Nixon's opponent in the upcoming election, promised to get the United States out of Vietnam while Nixon promised to win the war. But after winning re-election, Nixon let Kissinger give South Vietnam away to the communists. He had promised Americans peace with honor, but his tenure had only meant more American lives lost in a war that the government never had the planning or the guts to do what it took to win. Next, I went on to Bangkok, the Venice of the Orient. The city impressed me greatly, and I had an opportunity to go to the beautiful coast at Padua. Boiled seafood halfway around the world from my native New Orleans cooked seafood. It looked, it smelled, and tasted exactly what I was used to back home, and I had some other dishes with very similar French-style cooking. I noticed that Bangkok, for all its historic places and special beauty, seemed to have a more primitive character about it than Vietnam. Finally, I boarded a train for Vientiane, which was just across the Mekong River from northern Thailand. As the train rumbled north from Bangkok, cultivated landscape increasingly gave way to thickening jungle. Sturdy brick and wood houses diminished to bamboo huts with thatched roofs. The farther north we traveled, the children wore less clothing, while the adults wore more jewelry. They wore their savings accounts around their necks in an almost pure form of 24-karat reddish-tinted gold. Finally, about dusk, we came to the station, which was near the Mekong River. I grabbed my bags and found out that I had to hail a water taxi to cross the river to Vientiane, Laos. The boats seemed almost as narrow as a Louisiana pirogue, but they had big automobile engines ingeniously mounted on a swivel in the boat with a 12-foot propeller-ended driveshaft trailing in the water behind it. They turned the boat by turning the engine on its swivel, and when they gunned the engine, those boats put on an incredible burst of speed that could practically knock you off the boat if you were not braced for it. The pilot had a large transistor radio blaring the ending of some sort of Asian song broadcast from one of the nearest Thai stations. About halfway across the river, at the very same moment when I considered the fact that I was almost exactly halfway around the world from my beloved Louisiana, the radio came alive again. When I was a little bitty baby, my mama used to rock me in the cradle in them old cotton fields back home. It was down in Louisiana, just about a mile from Texarkana, in them old cotton fields back home. Then before we arrived at the other side of the river, the next song was Creedence Clearwater Revival's Born on the Bayou. It seemed I wasn't so far from home after all. Vincennes had some paved streets, but a lot of dirt ones, and it had a thriving American community that was part of the American aid effort. Unlike Vietnam, Laos was officially neutral and had embassies from all over the world, including Communist China and Russia, as well as the USA. Quietly, American personnel under the cover of USAID and other programs were aiding the Royal Laotian government in their war against the communist Pathet Lao. I got across the river an hour later than scheduled, but I could see Father patiently waiting for me, standing beside his 1968 Chevrolet Caprice station wagon. It was wonderful to see him. It had been 8 months since his last visit to the States. He had a two-bedroom white stucco bungalow in a modest neighborhood near the embassy district. At the door was his housekeeper cook, a freckled and thin Laotian named Mething, who spoke broken English. But she had a wide smile, accented by quite a few missing teeth. My third day there, I awoke to find a young cobra in the living room. It had squeezed in under our door, and with a carved 3-foot decorative fork plucked from the living room wall, I got a chance to practice the skills I had honed long ago in Louisiana. I captured him and set him free down the road in some thick underbrush. While Father worked at the civil engineering section closer to town, I took the car to the English language school on the northern outskirts of town. My students in advanced military English were all Army and Air Force officers, the cream of the Laotian upper classes, and generally very intelligent. All of them were intensely anti-communist. We taught with a repetition and illustration method that is used in teaching English to people of any language around the globe. Some of my students would go on to further training in the United States, usually at Fort Hood or Fort Knox. Others would use their increased language skills and their advanced military training by American military advisors. Laos is the crossroads of Southeast Asia, and many different racial groups exist there. Among my students, I had very light-skinned and fairly tall Chinese, two darker and smaller Thai types. I also had many who were simply called Lao, who looked like a cross of the two. I had a couple of students who looked like the primitive Montagnards, as well as some Vietnamese. The different Asian races had distinct features and personalities, and they also differed in intelligence. The Chinese in my classes typically caught on the fastest, followed by the Vietnamese, the Lao, the Thai, and generally last came the Montagnards. The pattern held up fairly consistently, as the lighter-skinned Laotian usually excelled over his more Thai-like Laotian counterpart. Some of the Thai were very dark, with wide, flat noses and large lips, with a strongly negroid appearance, even though their hair was straight. I wondered if they were at least partially descended from the same ancient race that fathered the Australian Aborigines. On the opposite hand, some of my higher-ranking Chinese students had skin as light as any white man's, along with sharp features and thin lips. It was only their epicanthic fold that gave them away. And in many of them, their eyes had only a slight fold, somewhat like Mexicans or Indians who happen to have a lot of white blood. I wanted to know if there had been many white incursions in the Chinese gene pool in the provinces where these lighter Chinese came from. My anthropology textbook at LSU showed a line of prehistoric Caucasian migration all the way across China. And Willis Cardo's Western Destiny presented evidence of whites in the Americas thousands of years before Columbus. New evidence shows clearly that early Aryans introduced the wheel and the chariot as well as the domesticated horse to ancient Asia. Recent findings of ancient Caucasian mummies show the advanced cultural attributes of European settlers across Asia. And by the way, as a side note for the audio edition, the evidence continues to mount. In fact, including the Americas, almost all of the oldest skeletons, the oldest remains found in the Americas, have distinctly Caucasoid features. As you know, any good forensic scientist can look at a skull and determine the race of the person by the structure of the skull. And the skulls found, such as the oldest skull in all the Americas, which is in the University Museum in Mexico City, shows distinctly Caucasoid features. And the person in charge of that issue has said repeatedly, who is Mexican, that this is distinctly a European artifact. This is a European skull, and this is very interesting material, but it kind of shows you how that we are losing and we really don't understand some of the modern issues facing our society. We hear so much about white people, Europeans displacing the Indians, and what happened to the Indian people on this continent. Very little is talked about the fact that the first settlers of America, at least that's most of the evidence anyway, were Europeans, and they themselves were genocided and destroyed by Asian immigration. It kind of shows you a perfect example of how we have a situation in this society where we have a very strange morality that simply suits the people who are expressing the morality. The truth is the earth has had many migrations throughout history, and to go back hundreds of years or thousands of years and try to assign guilt, it's just not something that's conducive to creating a world that really works for people today, and the peace and the kind of relationships that we need to be able to maintain our cultures and our civilizations, our rights and our heritages without infringing upon the rights of others. Anyway, back to the text. Like most third world cities of any size, the auto traffic in Vientiane could become very harrowing. One afternoon while I was driving down the narrow streets near the embassies, a bicyclist darted out from behind two parked cars directly into my path. I threw on my brakes and swerved to the right to avoid her, but my car clipped the fender of a stopped automobile. I was surprised to see a tall, blonde Russian get out of the car. He could speak rather good German and a little English, and although I couldn't speak Russian, I knew a bit of German from my college courses, and through the two languages we communicated pretty well. After he and I discussed the minor accident, he introduced himself as Peter, and we went next door to a French coffee shop and began to talk about our respective nations and the politics of each. I mentioned that I was opposed to Nixon's initiative to the Red Chinese. Peter grinned and said in words that I well remember to this day, "Yeah," he said, "we white men must stick together." I was dumbfounded. I thought, I'd love to hear an American diplomat say that just once. After a while, we both felt comfortable and discussed many serious things and even shared some jokes. I decided to ask Peter about the Jewish influence in the Soviet Union. At first, he did not understand what I was talking about, but then he smiled and took his forefinger and drew an imaginary semicircle out from the bridge of his nose, an instantly understandable international description. He told me that Jews still had a lot of influence in Russia, but that it had greatly declined since the days of the revolution. He also told me that they dominated organized crime, which he said was a serious problem in his nation. He told me that their crime network had even extended to a handful of Jews in Laos who imported drugs into Mother Russia. He also told me that Zionism had gained much ground in the Soviet Union, and now that Jews had slipped from the pinnacle of power they once held, many were trying to undermine the state, thinking that in chaotic times they could work their way back into power. As I stood listening to this Russian in the streets of this third world capital, far away from our respective nations, I began to see more clearly than ever that political forms have very little importance compared to the racial currents underneath them. If what Peter said was true, and that the Jews had turned against their baneful creation of communism, then their organized opposition around the world, plus their still considerable power inside the Soviet state, could well result in its fall. Now, that was an unheard of thought in 1971. For then it seemed the Soviet Union was as solid as steel. As an American, for years I have been taught about the Russian enemy. And even after I learned about the true nature of the Russian Revolution, that it wasn't really Russian, I still had negative feelings toward Russians. Perhaps I still held the rape of Eastern Europe and Germany against them. My meeting with Peter, however, made me understand more clearly that it was not the Russian people who were our fundamental enemies. They had been used and exploited the same way that American policy had been perverted in the Mideast. In addition to my teaching, I was anxious to do something more to directly help the anti-communist war effort in Laos. I traveled to some of the outlying areas of Laos with my father, flying with Air America pilots to the most remote regions of the country. Air America was a quasi-U.S. government airline that supported the anti-communist effort in Southeast Asia. It was a ragtag group of aviators. Some were veterans, and some were novices who flew both aircraft and helicopters in support of anti-communist civilian and military forces. Once we flew to the far northwest village of Ban Hoi Sai, only about 10 kilometers from the Chinese border. I made friends with some of the Air America pilots and hitched rides with them as they made their rice and munition drops to the anti-communist villages and military forces of Laos. Some of them were deep in enemy territory. These pilots included some of the best in the world, many having flown during both the Korean and the Second World War. A couple of times our plane encountered some fire. Once during a low altitude rice run, I was readying for a drop near the open back cargo doors when we suddenly encountered some flak. I suddenly felt as though someone had just punched me in the side. I thought I had been hit seriously until I saw a small glistening fragment of shrapnel protruding from my thick webbed canteen belt. I dug the shrapnel out with my pocket knife and examined it. It was no bigger than a split lima bean, but it left a bruise the size of a half dollar. Father had been worried about my safety on the missions, so I didn't tell him about that experience till after I stopped doing them near the end of my stay in Laos. The stark beauty of the country enthralled me. Flying up to Luang Prabang, the royal capital, one could see granite spires reaching hundreds of feet out of the jungles. They were covered by the greenest of exotic vegetation that seemed to scratch against the clouds. Hiking back into the jungle, I found more varied wildlife than I ever saw in my Louisiana swamps. A lot of the terrain was practically inaccessible for hundreds of square miles. It was sparsely populated, often by tribes that seemed barely out of the Stone Age. It was no wonder the Pathet Lao guerrillas controlled most of the countryside. No government could ever control those who chose to dwell in such an environment. I also realized why the communists were able to provide for their forces in South Vietnam, despite the heavy bombing of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. If the terrain was as thick and as mountainous as what I saw in Laos, it would have been almost impossible to detect the communist enemy, and then only a direct hit of a 1,000-pounder could do any real damage. Living with my father in Laos, I felt closer to him than I had since I was a young man working beside him in the homes that we built. He was in his late 50s and he looked much younger, and he acted the same way. He always had a way of putting everything in the best light, and he loved to point out that temporary disappointments could work out for the best in the long run. He had determined in his own mind that all disappointments would eventually work out for the best. If one will just lead his life with that certainty, that's the way it would turn out. In late August, I said goodbye to my father and Laos and left for further adventures in India, Israel, and Europe. The next chapter is chapter 31, My Indian Odyssey. A ghost from India haunts me still.